Wallace Bruce wrote, "The Hudson, more than any other river, has a distinct personality, an absolute soul quality, with moods as various as the longings of human life." It often seems, he wrote, that there are really four separate Hudsons: the Hudson of beauty, the Hudson of history, the Hudson of literature, and the Hudson of commerce. Earlier this summer, the Hudson River was designated an American Heritage River by President Clinton. There seemed to be little doubt that the mighty Hudson would be selected, for the river mirrors much of the nation's own triumphant and turbulent history. It is a river that was fought over during the American Revolution. In fact, a third of the Revolution's battles were waged along its shores. It figures prominently in literature and gave birth to the Hudson River School of Painting and the modern environmental movement. The source of the Hudson can be found at Lake Tear of the Clouds in the Adirondacks. From there, the river, a tidal estuary, flows 315 miles to Upper New York Bay. The Algonquin tribes used the river as a trade route, but Italian navigator Giovanni de Verrazzano was the first European to see the river. That was in 1524. In 1525, Esteban Gomez from Portugal sailed to the harbor and named the river Rio de San Antonio. 84 years later, explorer Henry Hudson, an Englishman backed by the Dutch East India Company, sailed his ship the Half Moon up the river in search of a passage to the Orient. Following the Revolution, in 1807, Robert Fulton piloted his North River steamboat up the Hudson. The river was at its busiest in the mid-19th century, when the Erie and the Delaware and Hudson canals were opened. Traffic subsided when railroads cropped up on both sides of the waterway. Alan Newman is an historian and vice president of the group Hudson River Heritage.
The Hudson River is a highway. It was a transportation corridor. And where did the Hudson River Railroad go but right along the east bank of the Hudson, another linear corridor. Today we have Route 9, which was set up as the King's Highway, as the Albany Post Road, and it is parallel from New York to Albany, a parallel to the Hudson River. The New York State Thruway, again, parallel to the Hudson River. The Taconic State Parkway. And so we literally have this linear sense of our communities that even if you don't look at the river, you're still related to it in this very interesting way.
We're sailing down the Hudson, sailing down the Hudson, sailing down the Hudson, let your soul run free. Sailing down the Hudson, sailing down the Hudson, sailing down the Hudson to the clear blue sea.
The beauty and spectacle of the Hudson River helped spawn an artistic and literary industry. The Hudson became immortalized through classic literature by Washington Irving and James Fenimore Cooper, among others. The Hudson River School impacted the art world. A group of 19th century U.S. landscape painters, such as Thomas Cole and Asher Durand, created masterpieces, such as Cole's Storm King on the Hudson and Frederick Church's Hudson River at Sunset. While art flourished along the river, fishing became prominent, both recreational and commercial. Yet another reason, according to writer and environmentalist Bob Boyle, why the river is so significant.
It's the only major estuary on the Atlantic coast of the United States that still retains all of its original fish species. You can't say that for other estuaries. It's unique, and as such, it has served as sort of a Noah's Ark for rivers in the East and, in fact, rivers across the country.
Because of the large population of fish and the variety, the commercial fishing industry on the river once flourished. John Cronin is the Hudson River riverkeeper and a former commercial fisherman.
We had a commercial fishing industry here that dated back to when the Dutch settlers really first learned how fishing techniques from the Indians that were here and where to fish. And we've had an unbroken chain of commercial fishing ever since then. When I was a commercial fisherman back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, there were still a couple hundred fishermen left on the Hudson River. And that was down from an all-time high of probably 1,000 or more commercial fishermen on the river. In 1998, there were, I think, 15 fishermen left.
Cronin says that increasing restrictions on the fishing industry led to its decline.
It used to be that you could fish almost year-round on the Hudson River, and you just changed your gear and your locations according to the species that were around. But now you're not allowed to fish for striped bass or eel or catfish or carp or perch. The only fish you're really allowed to fish for anymore are shad. They're only here for 6 weeks. And you're allowed to crab for blue crabs. And that's a, but that's a very small fishery. So we're seeing our commercial fishery close up. Every year there are fewer fishermen. By the year 2000, I doubt we'll have more than four or five fishermen even fishing on the Hudson River. And that is one of the tragedies. And it's a tragedy directly attributable to pollution, in this case, PCB pollution.
Shad boat, pickle boat, lying side by side. Fisher folk and sailor men waiting for the tide. Rain cloud, storm cloud over yonder hill. Thunder on the Dunderberg, rumbles in the kill. Choo choo to go ahead.
The Hudson River's history book does contain a large section on pollution. As PCB pollution dominates the latest chapters, decades ago other types of pollution were affecting the river. Both industrial and residential pollution made the river the punchline of many jokes. Bob Boyle.
It was raw sewage going in from, for example, from the west side of New York, the so-called medical center outlet, because it was below the Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center. I think that that sewer outlet released the wastes, if you want to call them the wastes, of somewhere on the order of 750,000 people in Manhattan and the Bronx. You know, if somebody was cutting up something in a Chinese restaurant, or a murderer was disemboweling someone in a west side duplex, or whatever all, or someone was defecating, you know, on top of Grant's tomb, it would go right into the Hudson River.
And Boyle says New York City was not the only culprit.
Of course, there was pollution from Newburgh, Poughkeepsie, villages like Croton-on-Hudson, Irvington, all of them. So they were all pooping and peeing in the river.
And riverkeeper John Cronin, who began his career investigating industries, remembers how business often abused the Hudson.
The General Motors Company in Tarrytown, New York, you could tell the color of the river. You could tell the color. They were painting cars that day by looking at the color of the river. That's what it was like in Tarrytown at the General Motors plant. If you went into Dutchess County where the dye factories were, you could tell what color they were dyeing fabrics that day by the color of the water. There was a candle company in Newburgh, New York, in Orange County, where there was wax all over the place. I mean, what's more recoverable than wax? A few things. But that was the way industry operated. The General Electric Company, when it was making transformers, when it filled the transformers up with oil, all the oil that was left over was just washed into the river. It wasn't even recovered. So that was the way the river was being treated.
May the power of the people be heard on each shore and bring old Father Hudson clear water once more.
The Hudson River has been called the cradle of the modern environmental movement. That began in the early 1960s when a group of individuals, including Bob Boyle and performer Pete Seeger, began to point out the needs for environmental awareness, as well as cleanup. Pete Seeger remembers when he first felt that action had to be taken.
About 40 years ago, I started earning a little money, and I bought a little plastic bathtub of a boat and was sailing. And I saw lumps of this floating by along with the toilet paper, and the phrase of John Kenneth Galbraith came to mind, private affluence, public squalor.
Identifying the problem was one thing. Getting anything done about it was quite another. John Cronin says those early environmentalists had an uphill struggle.
What you have to appreciate for the way things were in the 1960s is that it was not like it is now. People were not embracing environmental issues. As a matter of fact, in the 1960s, you were as liable to be called a communist as anything else. If you said pollution had to be fought and industries had to clean up, you were a subversive. Of course, now in the 1990s, even the worst kind of polluters like to say that they're environmentalists too.
Seeger, while often quite modest about his achievements in getting laws passed to clean up the river, concedes progress was made.
The first job we did was to persuade the federal government and state governments to put in sewage treatment systems So that now the Hudson is mainly swimmable again. In fact, they have swimming races around Manhattan every summer now.
And John Cronin says he can see a visible improvement in the river from what it used to be.
There was a time when going out on the river near any of the cities on the river, whether it's Albany or Poughkeepsie or Newburgh or Kingston or Peekskill, Yonkers, Nyack, any place you went on the river, you would see raw sewage and oil slicks. These days, if there's so much as a small slick on the river, or one floating piece of sewage, our phone starts ringing off the hook.
However, just because the Hudson is cleaner to the naked eye, it does not mean it is without pollution. Lurking in the sediment of the riverbed and within the fish that call the river home, there is an industrial chemical. A chemical at the root of public debate from the crowded streets on Manhattan to the town halls of the Hudson Valley to the farms of northern New York's Washington County. This simple compound, called polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, has sparked some of the angriest and most expensive debate New Yorkers have ever faced, pitting environmentalists against farmers, industry against agency, each debating the issues surrounding the chemical's cleanup, nature, and even toxicity. It's an issue that harkens back to the original battle over Hudson River pollution in the 1960s, and one which may change the economic and environmental course of the river for years to come. For WAMC News, I'm Joe Donahue.